The Guardian.
And now,
Tomorrow Radio. Who knows its nature?
You know that I am your friend. You don't have to do anything.
Stand by.
And curiosity often leads to trouble.
Make yourself free and comfortable. Loosen your clothes, move around, stretch. Stretch like a cat.
The Guardian Radio Hour on MTS.
A peculiar place to have a party.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Radio Hour. No, I'm not Kate Hutchinson with a heavy cold, but rather guest host Ben Beaumont Thomas, one of the culture editors of The Guardian. When I heard that this next guest was coming in to do a show, I locked Kate in the stationery cupboard because I really wanted to meet him. I'm a massive fanboy of his band. They're one of my favourites, and so I'm very excited to say that today we have the drumming, super-producing polymath that is John McIntyre of the Chicago band Tortoise. John, how's it going?
Great, thanks for having me.
How was that introduction for you? Was that suitably?
Can you tone it down a little
bit?
Yeah,
I'm batting my eyelids at him across here. So what's the theme that you've gone for today's show?
Well, I guess I tried to go back as far as I could in the rich history of Chicago music. I suppose I could have gone back a little bit further to the first wave of the jazz scene in the early part of the 20th century. But so we're starting, I guess, in the 50s and coming up basically to the present.
And so everything we're going to hear today is all Chicago
based.
Yeah. Well, there's some absolutely brilliant music coming up. We've got greats such as Sun Ra, the before today unknown to me, Breeze Glass, which is one of Jim O'Rourke's projects. We've got some Jacking House from Adonis. We've got a Tortoise track in there. There's loads to talk about. So let's get started with our first track. We couldn't talk about Chicago without talking about this man. It's Howlin' Wolf with Smokestack Lightning. So, John, you, of course, play in Tortoise, who have an excellent new record out in The Catastrophist, but you also play in The Seeing Cake, who are another of my favourite bands, and you're a sort of go-to producer for all kinds of different stuff. You've done Stereolab Records, Antibalas, Broken Social Scene, Teenage Fan Club, Tom Zay, all sorts of different people. But Tortoise themselves, for those people listening who might not be familiar, what's the kind of vibe that you guys play?
Well, we're a five-piece instrumental band. We've been together for almost 25 years now, if you can believe that. and we have a sort of unusual instrumentation. We're all multi-instrumentalists to a degree. So there are three of us that play drums, and we also double on keyboards and mallet percussion and some bass, and we draw influences from a very wide variety of music, and it all gets mashed together
right
some kind of crazy way.
And The Catastrophist, this new album, it kind of has quite a sort of strongly tangible Chicago link, right? It was sort of developed out of work with Chicago musicians.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, we got a commission from the city to write some original music for a performance at Millennium Park, which is this very well-known space right downtown with the Frank Gehry-designed pavilion. And the the commission was specific in that they wanted us to invite guests from the jazz and improvising music community to play along with us. So we wrote, I think, five pieces with that intent. So we performed that at Millennium Park and then a few other places with different guests. And when we got serious about actually trying to work on a new record, which didn't happen until 2013, we knew that we already had that stuff in hand. So we decided, let's
start
with
work.
Let's see what we can do with this. But it actually ended up being transformed pretty significantly.
And what does sort of Chicago have, you know, in the water, in its bones, that makes something feel tangibly from that city? Is there something that the musicians all share and sort of riff off of from the city itself?
I don't know. I mean, we get asked this a lot, and it's pretty hard to articulate anything in particular. I mean, when I was thinking about all these tracks that are on the list here in general, I feel like there's this very strong DIY independent aesthetic that has always existed there. You know, there's always been really great independent labels and independent studios, and it seems like there's just this spirit of wanting to produce work kind of on your own terms, which is really, really important.
Do you think that's from being sort of stuck out in the Midwest, sort of between New York and LA?
That's an aspect of it. Yeah. I mean, there's no big media or corporate sort of things that you have in the coastal cities. You know, I think historically also it's been kind of a cheaper city to live in. That's obviously changing now. But like for me, well, I grew up in Oregon, but I went to school in Ohio. And it seems like almost everybody that was in the Midwest kind of gravitated towards Chicago, at least in the 90s. Mm. That was the scene. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we open with Howlin' Wolf, and I think the blues is something that if you're a tourist going on holiday to Chicago, that's the sort of music that you're sort of slapped around the face with.
Yeah.
Is it a core part of the city's musical identity, or is it a bit of a kind of Blues Brothers-y kind of tourist attraction?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is more of a historical thing now than anything else, yeah.
Right. And obviously, alongside the blues scene was evolving this jazz scene, which obviously has taught us is a major component with your playing. One of the most celebrated Chicago players, I guess, was, of course, Herman Poole Blount, a.k.a. Sun Ra. What track have you chosen of his here?
Yeah, we're looking at Plutonian Nights. So this would have been, do we know the date on this? I think it's
1966.
Yeah.
So that was Sun Ra's Plutonian Nights, kind of when he's starting to go from a sort of big band player into this mad interstellar Voyager he was later on. What kind of drew you to that track out of all of his ridiculously large back catalogue?
I think this is, well, interesting because I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe John Gilmour and Marshall Allen just started playing with him right around that time.
Which is the orchestra as it's kind of known today.
Marshall, he's still leading it, yeah. So I feel like this was kind of, like you said, you know, the stepping off point for the real identity that we associate with Sun Ra.
Yeah. I mean, do we forget sometimes that he had that sort of quite trad roots?
Right, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, his career goes back to the 40s.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And the jazz scene in Chicago, I mean, it encompasses quite a wide variety of different things. I mean, is there a Chicagoan voice to the jazz scene as there is in the blues, perhaps?
Gosh, I guess so. I mean, I feel like that is so much more vibrant, you know, at least just because I'm more familiar with a lot of the players. And we've also done things like we did a jazz festival in Germany with Fred Anderson, you know, playing a set with us. So, I feel like our band is interesting in that we have the ability to morph into different areas of musical exploration and collaboration. So it's really great.
Yeah, I mean, when you first kind of came up in the mid-90s, I think a lot of people, at least music journalists like me, would tag you with a sort of post-rock tag.
Yeah.
I've always maybe thought of you as more of a jazz group and much more rooted in that tradition. Yeah. Is that how you think of the band? Do you think of yourselves as jazz, in inverted commas?
No, not really. Right. I mean, we can't deny the fact that we're influenced by all of these things that surround us, you know. But I think we're more like a punk band in a right. way, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In that you just don't really care about the sort of conditions in which things are made.
No boundaries, no labels, you know, everything's fair game.
Yeah. Well, I think a band that has as much of a sort of free and open attitude to jazz and to performance is the Art Ensemble of Chicago. We're going to listen to something from them now. That was the Art Ensemble of Chicago with Theme de Yo-Yo from the soundtrack to Les Stars à Sophie. Why did you pick that? What really gets you about the Art Ensemble?
I don't know. For some reason, I've always been a big fan of that track in particular. They're a completely unique, you know, totally instantly identifiable voice. You know, it's amazing stuff.
Yeah. It feels, again, a bit in a sort of similar vein to Sun Ra, in that it has one foot in kind of the very sort of rhythmic bop world, and then one in this completely new world that jazz is finding itself in of complete freedom.
Absolutely.
Something that I think Chicago is less well known for than jazz is its psych scene. You've picked out something that's quite a curio here.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about Aorta and this track called Strange?
I don't know too much about this group. You know, this is kind of a recent discovery for me. But I think you're correct that there was like a little bubble of a psych sort of progressive scene late 60s, early 70s. And this is kind of an unknown gem from that era.
Okay. Well, this is Aorta with Strange. So we heard about the psych bubble. This is kind of taking us into Chicago's punk bubble. I think people in the UK, at least the sort of casual listener, would think of punk in America as being, you know, Ramones in New York and Misfits and in LA and pop punk, and then maybe sort of Fugazi and hardcore in Washington DC. Yeah. Did Chicago have its own kind of punk voice?
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And what was that?
Well, you know, I think the bands that most people would know about would be Naked Raygun and the Effigies, and then a little bit later on, Big Black, and the whole touch-and-go scene.
And were you always kind of drawn to punk? Were you a sort of teenager slamming his bedroom door to it? Or
Well, yeah, you know, I was trying to find out about as much as I could, you know, when there was limited access to things. We didn't have the internet, so it was, you know, you going down to the local record shop and trying to find the new unknown records, you know, when you're 15.
And so you just picked out the ones with the sort of snottiest covers.
Yeah, you know, you trust the guy at the shop to give you at least a good lead on something. Yeah.
Yeah, and did you feel like that Chicago and actually just punk generally in the U.S. at that point was really stepping beyond the sort of first template of it? What were they saying that was new that hadn't been said before?
Well, I feel like, you know, I think this kind of happened everywhere to varying degrees. Like, you know, you'd have this initial burst of really creative stuff, and then it would get like codified somehow, you know, like whatever. That's what happened with the Sex Pistols and the Clash and everything. And then all of a sudden, then you had like, you know, the great renaissance of British post-punk bands like the Raincoats and the Slits and This Heat and people like that. And I think that kind of happened in the States as well, as we had, you know, the hardcore scene, which, you know, there were some amazing bands like Minor Threat and Bad Brains and things of that ilk. And then that kind of ran its course, if you like. And then we had like, you know, the Big Blacks and other groups like that emerge a bit later on.
Yeah. Well, at the other end of the sort of musical spectrum is your next choice, which is, and we can possibly talk about Chicago without mentioning it, is a very jacking Chicago house track from Adonis. Were you there sort of getting sweaty in the music box? Or was, I guess this was still before your
before
time.
Before my time, yeah.
Did this music filter out of Chicago to a kind of wider national consciousness, or was it a real undercultural music?
Totally underground.
Yeah.
And I feel like, in a way, it was the early bands on Warp, like LFO, Nightmares on Wax, that kind of brought this awareness of this back to the States.
Mm.
So that was interesting.
Yeah, that's and that seems to be one of the sort of weirdest parts of dance culture now, is that so much of it came from the US, and yet only recently has there been a real proper flourishing of it. I mean, why do you think it's taken America so long to get it?
I have no idea. I don't know. It's one of those inexplicable things.
Yeah. Well, it is truly inexplicable when you get the quality of something like Adonis. This is No Way Back. Was Adonis with No Way Back, that kind of unmistakable, echoey 808, gorgeous production. What kind of gets you going about that?
Well, I mean, this stuff is really interesting because they were using these instruments that were, most people kind of consider them toys, you know, the 303 and the 606 and the 808.
Yeah, like, it was like something you'd stick on to play with your home organ.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what Roland had in mind when they designed and manufactured these things, you know, because they were total flops when they came out, you know, and so that's why these guys, these producers, they could find them at the secondhand shop for basically nothing and they could make these amazing tracks that just sounded completely otherworldly.
Yeah. And is there a sense that any of this kind of incredibly sort of grid-like music and production, do you ever sort of lift anything for that for Tortoise?
Oh, we get into that for sure.
Yeah. And so working with these layers and sort of building up tracks is something you've done a lot as a producer of other acts. We mentioned the likes of Stereolab and Broken Social Scene, and you know, acts have a relatively wide variety of sort of playing styles. What do you find that you can sort of bring to the table as a producer? Why do people kind of ring you up?
I guess maybe there's a kind of versatility that I have, you know, because I, you know, my background is in percussion, you know, so I, not just playing the drum kit, but orchestral percussion, actually. And I studied at a conservatory, so I do have a bit of
chops.
Knowledge about the technical side of all this stuff. So I feel like it's easy for me to jump into a situation, and if I, you know, have an idea, I can articulate it and execute it relatively quickly, hopefully.
Yeah.
But also that I can bring a lot of different options to the table.
And so it is quite a sort of collaborative process, or are you a bit, do you have to be a little bit sort of dictatorial about things?
No, it's totally collaborative.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's always the best situation. Like, just off the top of my head, thinking about the Stereolab records, those were full on collaborations.
Yeah. And another sort of Chicago producer and incredible musician that we are about to listen to next is Jim O'Rourke. How does he fit into Chicago? Because he seems to have done a little like you have, a bit of everything. He's sort of played mad noise and sort of process music. He's done you know, a series of incredibly lush FM rock records.
Yep.
How does he fit in, and does he again have a kind of place in Chicago, do you think?
I mean, I think for a lot of people, he kind of is symbolic, even though he hasn't lived there since 1999 or something.
Right.
But like, yeah, everybody associates Jim with Chicago, and especially during the 90s when he was really active. I mean, he's insanely productive. You know, I don't know how many records he's made, probably 60 or 70,
right.
you know, as a collaborator or on his own. And the fact that he can so easily just jump between different styles of playing and also, you know, being a producer as well as an artist.
Do you think that's then helped to define the essence of a kind of Chicago sound that people think of when they think of your label, like Thrill Jockey?
Yeah.
or these kinds of slightly jazz-inflected, psych-inflected kinds of guitar music a lot of the time?
Yeah.
Is Jim helped to shape that and has that kind of ultimately created a voice for Chicago?
I think so, yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Well, we're going to listen to this now, which is a group featuring Jim doing some kind of mad cut-up production methods. This is Breeze Glass with Neither Yield Nor Reap.
Thank you.
So we went from one beloved Chicago cult figure, Jim O'Rourke, with his project Breathe Glass, into another, which was Plush, and that was Three Quarters Blind Eyes. Plush is kind of the project of Liam Hayes. Who is this chap, John?
Wow. Where do I begin? No, he's amazing. He's an amazing musician. Horribly underrated, unknown, but just fantastic.
Yeah. Has it all got this rather sort of bright kind of prairie skies sort of aspect to it?
It's... No, actually, he's got some stuff that's pretty dark sounding.
Yeah.
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 His discography is very limited, unfortunately, but I feel like he probably has hundreds of songs that he's written. I think his most well-known record is called Fed. Famously took years and years and years to make.
Was he kind of squirreled away in a sort of corner of Chicago? Was he plugged into a scene?
No. I mean, that's the funny thing about Chicago is that, like, especially in the 90s, all of this stuff was coexisting. You know, like, we'd go see Liam play one night. We'd see, you know, Jim do a solo thing or a collaborative thing. We'd see a jazz show, free jazz show. You know, it was all kind of happening and, like, feeding off each other.
Well, this brings us up to, we're going to play a track from the new record. And with Tortoise themselves, what does that band kind of bring you that none of the other projects that you work on do?
I mean, it's really about the five of us collaborating. You know, it's like always just a process of discovery, trying to challenge ourselves, you know. And I feel like there's, even since the beginning, there's been like this collective identity that we have. And it hasn't really changed that much, even though maybe on the surface some of the details have changed. But I feel like there's kind of an unspoken understanding about what we can do in the band, which is obviously very open, but, you know.
Can you characterize that as a sound?
Or... No.
Right.
Not at all.
And I guess maybe as soon as you did it, you would lose it.
But the funny thing is, even though I can't really characterize it, I feel like at this point, anybody who's somewhat familiar with us could hear something new and be like, oh, that's a Tortoise track. You know? So...
How does it work when you're in a studio or even before a sort of studio point? How do you kind of build up these tracks? Is it sort of jamming? Is it people have little ideas and bring them to a table?
Yeah, there's no jamming, really. We've tried that. It doesn't really work.
How does that sound? Just like a sort of awful dirge? Or...
Well, actually, it's interesting. There is a release. I think it may have been Japanese only. There's a track called Ice Ice Gravy, which is basically just a bunch of edits of, you know, jam sessions that we did. It's kind of satisfying.
This is your comedy jams.
You're right. Yeah. It turned out all right. But, you know, in retrospect, I don't think we could have used any of those ideas as foundations for what would be album tracks. So we do, as you said, everybody kind of submits demos of ideas that could be very, very basic or more composed, if you will. And then we just collaborate, you know.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and this new record has some interesting curveballs that almost sound like they're the product of thinking, right, we're just going to come in at this with a 90-degree angle.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a beautiful ballad with Georgia from Yola Tengo.
Yeah.
You have a cover of Rock On by David Essex on there. How did these kind of things emerge out of your minds?
I guess at a certain point we decided, okay, we could do some tracks with vocals, you know, just for fun, because we haven't really done that very much. And we knew that we wanted Georgia to sing on something, but we didn't know what. And I guess at some point also Doug and I were just talking about it, about Rock On and how much we loved the original version, in fact. And
why do you love it so much?
It's completely bizarre, especially for 1973 or whatever it was. Yeah, the production is amazing.
And for a housewife's favorite as well.
Right. The reception is much different to that track in the States, I suppose, but I don't know. we just decided, we didn't even know if it was going to make the album. We just wanted to do it, you know. Luckily, Todd Rittman from U.S. Maple and Dead Rider agreed to sing on it, and he did an incredible job. So.
Well, thank you. We've kind of unfortunately run out of time. I could nerd out on this stuff all day, but that is everything. Next week, Kate Hutchinson will be back in this seat at the very same time. For now, thank you so much, John, for an amazing journey through Chicago. We're going to finish, as I said, with Tortoise. This is from The Catastrophist. This is Guest Gap.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.